And welcome to Indie Business Radio for Monday, October 12, 2009. I'm your host, Donna Maria, and you have arrived at the one place where we empower you to enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way. Today's show is sponsored by PitchRate.com, helping you connect with the media for free. Find out more and register to receive your free media leads at PitchRate.com. Well, speaking of the media, we all know that these days social media is all the rage. And it's not just a fad, as some people would have you think, and Twitter is a big part of the reason why social media is here to stay, and also very useful for small and independent business owners. Today's guest, Shel Israel, has studied some of the best examples of businesses using Twitter, and he's here to share some of what he's discovered with us. Shel is the author of Twitterville, How Businesses Can Thrive in the New Global Neighborhoods. He is a social media journalist and a public speaker. He has contributed to FastCompany.com, BusinessWeek.com, and the Dow Jones Company. He is the co-author with Robert Scoble of Naked Conversations, How Blogs Are Changing the Way Businesses Talk with Customers, and author of The Conversational Corporation, a Dow Jones ebook. Welcome to the show, Shel.
It's a pleasure to be here, Donna Maria. Thank you for having me.
Well, if you're listening to the show at IndieBusinessRadio.com, be sure you choose the correct player for you and turn your volume up so you don't miss a word of this show. If you'd like to join us in the chat room, just look right there on the homepage for the link to join us using Saver Chat. You can join through Facebook or Twitter. I usually use Twitter because it does a great job of sharing the conversation, speaking of which, we're going to be talking about that with Shel today. So, Shel, I find it really interesting how people discovered Twitter and what their first impressions were compared to what they become after a few months of tweeting. Tell us first how you found your way to Twitter and what were your first impressions.
Well, I found my way to Twitter the same way almost everybody does. A bunch of my friends said, hey, you got to try this. And my response when I first looked at it was probably the same as almost everyone who goes to Twitter. I was absolutely clueless. I posted my first tweet. It's about the same as everybody else's, but at the time I thought I was being brilliant. I said, here I am, what happens now? And I did nothing. I went away for about 3 days, and I came back, and there were about 45 people following me. Over half of them are people I didn't know. And that kind of flipped me out a little, because why were these people following me? I wasn't going anywhere. Were they stalkers? What did they want from me? So I think that's what happens when most people get there. It's mechanically very easy to use Twitter, but it takes a while to start understanding the value. And in researching Twitterville, three-quarters of the business people I spoke to, everyone from home office and small business, which I know is your focus, to global enterprises, I got stories that always began with, well, we got there to do this, but once we were there, we discovered that, and that was much more valuable than what we came to do to begin with.
Interesting. And so today, it's very different for you on Twitter, isn't it?
Today, I kind of got the hang of it.
Yes, and I'm so glad that you're here to share some of the things that you've learned with us. Now, you did a lot of in-depth background research into the nitty-gritty, the whole detailed story about how Twitter got started, and you guys can read all those details. They're really interesting in Shel's book, but once you collected all that information and historical data, what did you learn about how technology in general is being used in our lives as business owners that can be applied to us as Twitter users?
Let me do two parts there, because I'm really not a collector or an analyst of data. I'm essentially a storyteller, and the way I try to tell Twitter's story is I went out and I spoke to a whole mess of people. I wrote the stories of over 100 people, and I arranged them by small business, home office, up to global enterprise, business to business, and all the rest. And the hope is that other people will come, read the book, and say, wow, now I get it, and now I understand why I need to be there. Now I've got the second half of your question. What was that again?
And that was a good first half. I really wanted you to comment on, because you collected so much information and I guess read all those stories, what does it tell you and tell us? What are the instructions that we can learn about how technology impacts our lives generally from the story of Biz Stone and Ev and Biz getting together around Twitter?
Well, technology has been changing our lives ever since we were in the cave. And will continue to do so. People have stayed the same, in my opinion, throughout the millennia of human history. But if you look at that millennia of human history continuum, I think Twitter is the last dot on the right. It's the most recent thing that happened that changes the way people interact. It changes what a marketplace is. It reduces geography so that someone with, there was an article today in the local paper in Salt Lake City talking about all these Utah small businesses. It's on the Lex blog if anybody wants to go look at it. But it talks about how all these small businesses are using Twitter to talk to customers, to bring customers in, to start businesses, and how they no longer have to be local stores in Park City, Utah, but they can now address and talk to customers and learn from people all over the world. So what's special about Twitter to me is it is one of a whole arsenal of social media tools, and like a hammer in a carpenter's kit, works with all the other social media tools. And as it does, it really gives the little guy a big opportunity, because we're in a time when the small merchant has been drowned out of every way of talking to the market by larger companies with advertising, with huge budgets, and what was left to them is the yellow pages. The yellow pages themselves are going away now. And suddenly we have a way that when somebody has something useful or interesting to say, they can use Twitter to be heard. And that can change everything.
So if I'm a small business owner, Shell, and I've got my business plan together and I've begun to execute it, I've launched my website, my products are in place, I know who my target market is, what do you say to me if I haven't heard of Twitter, if someone comes along, maybe I'm listening to this show, and I'm like, oh my goodness, how do I possibly begin to embrace this as a marketing tool? How do you help newcomers understand that so they aren't turned off or scared off, I guess, at the very beginning?
Okay, the first thing is I'd advise them to skip the step where they spend all that money on a website. A website is static. You usually, if you're a small business person, pay a good deal of money to have somebody design it for you. And by the time it's up and running, it's probably a little bit obsolete, and the revisions are going to keep costing you money. I'd suggest you start with a blog site instead, which you can do yourself, and you can have simple conversations. You can pay a talented person to design that for you if you want, but it's not really necessary. But what you do when you first get to Twitter, if you're wise, is you listen and you watch. You don't come in talking. If you do, you're like the boor at a party who walks into a conversation that's going on already and says, "Hi, here I am, and let me tell you about the great real estate opportunities I have in Florida swamps," or whatever. Everybody else tends to walk away from that person. On Twitter, we can unfollow people, we can block people, so it's easy to walk away from people who come in talking and come in interrupting what's already going on. But if you come in listening and you start using the Twitter search tool to list topics that interest you, fashion, recipes, cooking, name the business you're in, real estate, sports, whatever topic you want, you will discover that there are hundreds, perhaps thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of conversations going on that are relevant to you. There's a whole network now of online handymen who use Twitter to give advice to homeowners all over the country and build up their own reputations in the areas that they serve.
Well, let's explore that a little bit. Skip the money you're spending on a website. Is that, you mean literally don't have a website, have a blog that connects to your customers and has your e-commerce mechanism built into it?
Yeah, a website was the state of technology in 1995, and it was pretty exciting when a company had a website and they had a presence. The problems with websites are about threefold. One is they're static. The minute you put them up, if you're a small business person who's not adept to technology, it becomes old. It becomes ancient. It's like if you change phone numbers in the Yellow Pages, you've got to wait a whole year before your listing is corrected. Number two is it's expensive and it's time-consuming, and almost every small business person I ever spoke to was not absolutely happy with what they got. It was what somebody did for them, and in the end, time and budget required that they said, okay, that's fine. And number three is that you can't learn from your marketplace. You can't learn from your customer what they're thinking on a website. There's no way of talking to you. You have a little button that says contact us, which gives them email or support at company.com. And that's just not as good as setting up a WordPress or a TypePad blog where you talk with customers and they talk back to you. You bring the conversation into other things. If your company has an outing, you put pictures up on Flickr and you write about that in your blog. You point to it with Twitter. So the website was a tool that predates social media. The difference between a website and social media is very simple. A website is one directional. I talk, you listen. The new social media tools change that to, let's have a conversation. And that's much more effective. And most small businesses understand that they learn as much as they give when they're talking with customers, prospects, members of their community.
Very, very salient advice. If you're interested in learning more about life in Twitterville and even exploring the specific thing that Shell just shared, you can join us here on Indie Business Radio. And if you want to go to indiebusinessradio.com, you can click on the link for the chat and you can join us and ask Shell some questions. Now, Shell, what you just said I think may come as a big surprise to a lot of small business owners. And let me clarify what I mean by small business owners, because in America, small is not necessarily small as most government agencies and state agencies define it. Our audience here are independent business owners, generally 1 to 2 employees, oftentimes no outside funding, and they have been told time and time again, website, website, website. And then someone comes along and starts talking about a blog. And what happens, Shell, and maybe you've experienced this too, is they become a little bit fearful of sort of stepping out from behind the veil that a website gives you and putting themselves out there. What tips can you offer in that regard?
I kind of think I just did in a lot of ways. There's always somebody giving you advice. Very often the advice is on conventional wisdom, and for a very long time in recent history they were told you have to have a website. But if they do have a website, they need to think about how happy they are with it, what it costs them, what return it's giving them. And I would guess your listeners will, in many cases, say, I'm just not quite happy with it. What I hear every time I speak to a small business person is I see eyes roll to the ceiling, and then I hear something about so out of date, or the guy who designed it used artwork I never really liked, but I couldn't tell him what I liked better. I hear there wasn't time. I hear, gee, I really have to fix that one of these days. And so every day that goes by, the thing gets older, the thing gets uglier, the thing gets less effective for their customers. With a website, you just post when you have something useful or interesting to say to the people you want to talk with. And I never say just customers, because small business is not about customers. The power of a small business is about a social network. Social networks have moved from the community where the business is located to to places you can't touch on the internet, places that are called virtual, such as Twitter, such as Facebook, such as blogging, and yet those places have people there, and the relationships that are formed there are very real, and the relationships that are formed there create friendships, make people better informed, they stay current, and oh yeah, business happens and sales happen.
Excellent advice. Small business is not about customers, it's about networks and relationships. That is very good advice, and I hope that everyone's listening out there is really taking that to heart, because it is the future of your business, and I don't think it's an overstatement to say that your adoption and embracing of that philosophy that Shel just shared is going to make or break your business in the coming years. We're going to take our first break, and we're going to come back and talk more with Shel Israel, author of Twitterville, How Businesses Can Thrive in the New Global Neighborhood. This is Indie Business Radio. We'll be right back.
Why is everyone listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com? Because it's the future of talk radio. Every day, more and more people are finding internet radio as not just an alternative media, but as a replacement to traditional AM and FM broadcast stations. Internet radio offers a wider variety of programs, convenient on-demand listening that meets your schedule, and fewer commercial interruptions. And GlobalTalkRadio.com is already leading the way by matching this content with a highly targeted internet audience. GlobalTalkRadio.com offers its listeners one of the widest programming varieties on the internet, from business and finance to self-improvement, paranormal, health, literature, romance, politics, and more. There are also opportunities for prospective hosts who would like to host their own weekly or one-time talk shows. Want to learn more? Check us out at www.globaltalkradio.com and see the future of talk radio today.
Welcome back to Indie Business Radio. We're talking today with Shel Israel, author of Twitterville, How Businesses Can Thrive in the New Global Neighborhood. Shel, your book describes Twitter and social media in some respects as what you call massive micro-marketing. What do you mean by that?
What I called it was mass micro-marketing. And again, but my voice is all creaky today, but my view of the world of commerce is that we're leaving an era that lasted for about 60 years called the broadcast era, and we're now entering into what I call the conversational era. In the broadcast era, the idea was to let everybody everywhere see the same thing, identify it with a brand, and therefore, if I am in Boston and I see a sign that says, let's pick somebody somewhere I like, Crate and Barrel, I know that when I go into that store, there will be a certain line of products that I'm familiar with, and it will be the same as what I see in the Crate and Barrel near where I am. And this kind of created a generic marketplace in not only America and the world. When I was in China, I was a little bit appalled to find out the favorite lunch place seemed to be Kentucky Fried Chicken, or KFC, as the brand now is called. And that's mass marketing. That's everybody watches the Super Bowl, you put an ad on the Super Bowl, and everybody in the world knows what your company is and what it does, and the brand is identified to the logo. Mass micro-marketing is absolutely the reverse of that. It's an idea that I had probably before our current economic woes, but once the economy went into the toilet, we had brand thinkers, and brand thinkers are not usually small businesses. They're the McDonald's of the world, and they started saying, "Wow, this advertising and PR and doing everything that we've always done the way we've done it just isn't producing the return it used to produce." And the brands we have are now looked upon as really non-differentiating. They're, you know, we tried so hard to make our McDonald's different than their Burger King, but in the eyes of the world, these are two icons that are part of fast food. We lost the sense that people like personalization, or another word you can say is humanization. We lost the fact that people want to be treated as individuals rather than a set of, as we said in the dot-com era, sticky eyeballs. And we're now coming to a point where the world's largest companies are trying to act like local companies. To do this, they're coming with great speed into social media, where they're trying to be more up close and personal than they've ever been than they've ever been before, but than they have been for the last 50 or 60 years. Compare this with a small business guy who knows everything about up close and personal. He's lived on it. He's lived on personal reputation. He's lived on one neighbor telling the other neighbor where to shop and what to buy and what to order in which restaurant. So this kind of changes the balance of power from the big brand merchants with big budgets to the local merchants who can now use the technique of being someone who gets business because they're reputable, they're respected, people talk about them. So mass micro-marketing is the realization that you can still address people all over the world, but you have to do it in a way that is personal, that is human. And in fact, this gives a home court advantage to the little guy for two reasons. Number one, they're more experienced at this. They're used to speaking with their own voice, when brand people are still learning that a company should not speak with one voice. It should speak with hundreds of voices, maybe thousands of voices. And the second part of it is that if you make something which is good, which is unique, which is interesting, you're no longer confined to the boundaries of a local merchant's turf. Local merchant's turf was a metropolitan area at the biggest. Now you can go online, and people can find you all over the world if they're interested in the goods or the services that you provide.
Excellent. And
sorry to be so long-winded, but that may be a book, so it's hard to say in just a couple of paragraphs.
Actually, in some respects, it's a couple of chapters in your book, which is one of the things that makes it so interesting, because what you just described is the very large multinational companies that have the money, the resources, the people to do basically whatever they want to promote their businesses, are using the same tools that someone with very, very little money is using, and both can do the same thing effectively.
Yeah, in the book, I think a good couple to look at are Ford Motors. Now, here's a company who has been using social media brilliantly, but I said a company when, in fact, most people who observe the company would say it's one person. His name is Scott Monty. He was known in the social media community before he joined Ford. And when Scott speaks, we already know him from our history. I mean, we, in this case, I'm being an elitist. Somebody who's been in social media a long time would say, I know Scott Monty. He's a truthful guy. I don't know that he's ever been caught telling a lie. So in the book, I talk about what happened when a little guy, a Ford Ranger fan, believe it or not, there seem to be people who are fans of the Ford Ranger. I'm not one of them. Posted late in one day that Ford had sent them a cease and desist letter, that Ford wanted $5,000 in damages, and that they were no longer allowed to identify with Ford on their fan site. This caused a very brief hellstorm. All the other fan sites for Ford, and there are many of them, said, are you going to do this to us? Why are you turning on your own fans? And it really looked ugly. Scott had worked about a 14-hour day that day. He was just about to go to bed when he saw all this stuff. And he just posted saying, wow, I don't know what's going on here. Please give me some time. It's the first thing I'll do in the morning. I'm going to check this out. While he slept, the thing kept going. By morning, and this isn't in the book, I've since learned, more than 10,000 inquiries and complaints had come into Ford through all the customer support channels. This was a real damaging thing. It was going on exactly at the time when the heads of American automotive companies were testifying in Washington, D.C. Not a good time for them. And the next morning, Scott jumped in. He said, let me talk to the lawyers. I got to find out what's going on here. A little later in the day, about 2 hours later, he said, all is not as it seems. There is some deception going on. Let me get to the bottom of the story. At which time, social media said, okay, Scott, and everybody stopped grumbling. Everybody stopped saying bad things about Ford. Everybody said, we'll let this guy have his say. Several hours later, it came back, and it turned out that the fan site had been selling counterfeit Ford copywritten material, their logos, their IDs, pictures from out of ads, had been selling it to its fans. It had been asked repeatedly for over a year to stop doing that. They had ignored it all. And then the lawyer said, okay, cease and desist. Scott said to the lawyers and to the company, hey, we're going to be a little less aggressive here. The idea is to get them to shut down. They got the Ford Ranger guy to post on his site that, yeah, he had overlooked saying this when he announced the cease and desist letter, and he has since gotten permission to reprint this material with a credit line that this is copywritten, and he isn't going to sell anything anymore, and he was allowed to continue, and the $5,000 was forgotten. And everybody just kind of smiled and walked away, and that showed how one person who understood how social media could work could resolve what was really a dangerous situation for Ford Motors and do it in less than 24 hours. And in so doing, for a large corporation, I'd ask every small business person in the world to say, think of what it can do for you.
Right. Right. That was a good example of some serious damage control there. So is it an overstatement, Shell, in your opinion, based on the stories that you've uncovered and shared with so many people, is it an overstatement to say that a small business owner really doesn't lack as much as they used to if they don't have any money because these technological tools like Twitter are available to them?
Social media evens the playing field. It doesn't make it a completely even field. If I started a car company in San Carlos, California, it would take some time before I could overcome Ford Motors. But it turns out some guys in San Carlos have started a company called Tesla, and they've done it on very little money. They're having their own problems, but they have a reputation which is astounding in building electric cars that can drive 120 miles an hour. In design genius, and one of the ways they've managed to get known is they have captured the hearts and minds of people in social media who are passionate about automotive.
So if you're a small business today,
and by the way, Tesla started with four people.
Right.
And they did have money. They were sequential entrepreneurs, so they had lots of money, and they had lots of people who believed in them. But four people have created an automobile industry that could end up being a multi-billion-dollar company in a short period of time.
So how have you observed some of these companies managing all of these different options that we have today? It can be a huge time sucker, I suppose, if you let it be. What are some tips some things that you saw the larger companies do that smaller companies do can do to manage their use of social media and make it, I guess, not be such a time sucker and really make it more productive and be able to see the results of it?
You know, time sucking is a funny term. It construes that what you're doing is less valuable than what else you're doing. So many small business people are spending so much time on social media because they're finding it more valuable than the things they used to do. So I don't buy the concept that people frittering away their time on Twitter is wasting business time. And then I would point out that for any small business person, there is a very, very gray area between personal time and business time altogether. They spend time at home doing business. They spend time during business dealing with who's going to pick up the kids. And it all integrates. And in fact, most people live that way. So any business really needs to think about how they spend their time. And I would maintain, particularly in small business, you need to spend your time getting as close with your customers as you possibly can. There is simply no question that the market is moving online. You know, I can remember seeing, I'll just name his title, a C-level executive from Barnes & Noble laughing about a question about whether Amazon.com was a threat to them because that little startup represented less sales in the year 1996 than Barnes & Noble was losing to shoplifters. And they just considered it insignificant that a little guy was going to take them on and do it just on the Internet. But it turned out people were going online. It turned out that Amazon.com could get closer to the customers, could find out what customers like better, could give customers better information than you can get in most bookstores. And the result is kind of historic proportions. Amazon.com is not only bigger than Barnes & Noble, it's the world's largest retailer now.
Mm-hmm.
And now we come along with a new chapter in technology evolution, the social media. And the little guy has a chance, he has a chance, but two is, he has to go online because that's where the customers are going. And if you want to see the future of where it's going, don't ask me, don't read any big marketing or analyst report. Go down the hall and talk to your kids. Watch their habits. Watch where they're spending their time, and picture what's going to happen as they grow up. The whole world is moving online. People online, instead of listening to advertising and PR campaigns, are talking to each other, and that's how most people are now deciding what they're going to buy, watch, listen to, where they're going to travel, where they're going to stay, where they're going to eat, and so on down the line.
Excellent. And your book does talk quite a bit about being involved in the conversations because they're going to happen whether you're there or not. And as a small business owner, everybody out there listening, you don't want to be left out of the conversations about what you have to offer.
A small business guy needs to go online for the same reason that politicians go to funerals. It's where the politician goes because that's where the voters are. The small business person has to go there because that's where the customers are.
That's where the people are. You heard it right here. Shel Israel, author of Twitterville, How Businesses Can Thrive in the New Global Neighborhoods. We've got one more segment left. Don't touch that mouse. We'll be right back to talk more with Shel about how you can use social media to maximize the success of your business.
Want to stay on top of what's new in the radio industry? Sign up for a free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio, available exclusively to listeners of globaltalkradio.com, and find out what's new in the world of online radio. Listeners can find out about new shows and special guests. People with something special to offer can find out how to become a guest and how to prepare for an interview. And prospective hosts will find a valuable resource for everything from planning their new program to selecting topics and guests, recouping expenses by selling advertising, and more. Sign up today for your free subscription to the Future of Talk Radio by visiting www.globaltalkradio.com and learn about the future of talk radio today.
Into Business Radio. We're here talking with Shel Israel, author of Twitterville. And one of the things that's fascinating about your book, Shel, is your conversation about what you call braided journalism. Tell us what that is.
Braided journalism is a concept that citizen journalism and professional journalism are coming together into social media. And I call it braided journalism because there are three strands there. Social media's had its own evolution. It's had nothing to do with reporting and journalism. And traditional journalism, when social media started, regarded social media reporting as no better than CB band radio DJs, overlooking the fact that CB band radio people of the 90s actually reported some pretty valuable news along with good buddy chatter. In the last year, it's become clear that traditional journalism is in enormous trouble, and most of us sane people realize the world will not be better without traditional journalism. We bloggers just don't get in to the White House to ask President Obama about health care. We don't get parachuted out of airplanes to cover wars. We really are unwashed, undisciplined, and untrained with two advantages. One is we're everywhere. We walk around with cell phones that can take pictures and videos, and we can tweet with them. We can post blogs with them if we want. And at a time when traditional journalism has had one budget cutback after another and has lost their networks of stringers of correspondents, we're replacing them for better or worse. In the last year, we've had one incident after another that's illustrated that. In China, I'm going to forget dates for a minute. A Dutch kid by the name of Casper Openhuis de Jong was Skyping home for money from Chitong, China, to Amsterdam on a Sunday night when the building started shaking, and it turned out that he was the first person, not the first, but among the first Westerners to know that the Sichuan earthquake had taken place. That within 60 miles of where he sat, 50,000 people had been killed, 250,000 people had been injured or homeless, or both. And from there was just a string of events that most of you listeners have heard about. Mumbai, where the press stayed away, but students with cameras went out and from the street showed the acts of terrorism that were going on there. Gaza, where on Twitter, people like me were having conversations with people in Gaza hating Israel and people in Israel hating Gaza, which was a very interesting time. The press was going there to get on-the-scene reports from areas where they were not physically present. Somebody who's since become my friend, and I just did an interview with him earlier this morning, Yanis Krums, was a 23-year-old who wanted to go to a conference in Manhattan. He was low on money, so he stayed in a hotel in New Jersey, parked his car, and took the ferry over. On the way back, a funny thing happened. While halfway across the Hudson River, U.S. Air Flight 1549 landed nearby. He whipped out an iPhone, took a picture of a plane with passengers on the wing sinking into the Hudson on a winter's day, clicked a photo on something that was brand new, 1 month old, called TwitPix, posted it on Twitter, went and helped specifically a flight attendant with two broken legs get rescued from the sinking airplane. He had loaned his phone to another passenger. When he received his phone back, he found he was talking to Bill Sullivan on MSNBC, and the conversation was live. Viewers all over the world were seeing the photo that he had taken on his iPhone and hearing his voice from the ferry. And 27 minutes had passed by since this incident had occurred. He was the media, and the rest of the media no longer looked at a citizen journalism with disdain. We're in an era where journalism is going through a wormhole. It's going to come out in a way that is different than it has been. The components are braiding together. There is a move called hyperlocal, which means that there may be a huge chance for very localized merchants, dry cleaners, coffee houses, etc., to sponsor very local news events, such as a city council meeting, a soccer game, a town fair, a street fair. And this is the kind of journalism we used to have, where local merchants could reach their communities through advertising there. Now they can not only advertise there, they can become the reporters. There's no need for professionalism. Most of us have lost our love for polish and sophistication. We'd rather have people make grammar errors, post typos, and just tell us what they saw happened. And we've also grown tired of pretenses of objectivity, because we all know that traditional media has been reduced to covering the polarity of a situation rather than the middle of the situation where most people exist. So there's a huge opportunity. There are hundreds of hyper-local journalistic activities going on. Nearly every single one of them uses social media. As a matter of fact, I think every single one of them uses social media. In that is a huge opportunity for small businesses. There's also the fact that every one of us, whether we like it or not, are like Janus Krums on the Hudson River. We are the media, whether we want to be or not.
So you have a journalism background. You are a journalist. How can you help small business owners without any experienced journalists to embrace the concept that you're talking about, which, and you just said, we are all, in some respects, the media, particularly where our businesses are concerned. Can you help us, you know, wrap our arms around that? It's like a whole new job we have to learn, is it?
No. It's, first of all, the deification of professional journalism is vastly overrated. I know you got that word from Amazon.com. What I had submitted was, I'm a social media storyteller. The difference between a storyteller and a journalist is I tell you my point of view. A journalist may tell you his point of view, his or her point of view, but they don't admit it. So what I advise people to do is use social media to report on what they see or hear, which is useful or interesting. And other people who find it mutually useful or interesting will find it. Every one of us is part of a network that contributes to an ever-increasing body of knowledge. Because of social media, the world is collectively smarter than it's ever been before. And every merchant has an opportunity to write with passion and zeal about things that they know about, and whether this is journalism or not, it will be. An example I would give you from the book is the story of United Linen, of Bartlesville, Oklahoma, which secretly is one of my two or three favorite stories in the book. This is a company who knows hard times. It was started in the Great Depression when a door-to-door salesman couldn't make ends meet, so he and his wife started taking in laundry. They became a regional cleaner for restaurants. In other words, the laundry service for tablecloths and napkins. They used social media to teach people 9 different ways of folding linen napkins in restaurants, making different impressions, setting different moods. They use social media when the phone lines are down during emergency storms to tell their customers when they're going to be able to deliver the clean clothes. And what they've become is experts reporting and educating people in near real time on a subject that's arcane to most of the world, but very, very valuable to the restaurant service industry.
So they're essentially tweeting about things and using social media to share things that have a connection to what it is they're selling.
Yep. They also sponsor Little League baseball teams, and they report the ball scores in real time as they happen, and of course there is no daily newspaper. By the time the ball scores are reported in the weekly newspaper, the game's a week old, and anybody in town who cared about it already knew. And how do they find out if they didn't go to the game? They find out because United Linen tweeted it.
And that's a good connection. And so small business owners can, who sometimes struggle, Shell, to make the leap to make that connection between what I'm sharing at my blog, what I'm tweeting about, and what it is that I'm selling, because I don't want to write a blog post that says, come buy all my stuff now.
Here's what I would point out to any small business person. First of all, I've been a small business person much of my life, and it is always a struggle. But in the times that I was involved in retail, I never made a sale by walking onto the retail floor and saying, hey, you going to buy something? That isn't how business starts. Business starts with, nice day, isn't it? Wow, it looks like we're going to have our first rainstorm of the year in California. Wow, I saw that. Did you buy that on sale at this store? We start with chatter. Sometimes that chatter leads to a sale in a matter of minutes. Sometimes absolutely nothing happens, but we enjoyed a few minutes of a decent conversation. The potential customer leaves without having bought something. They go home, and a few days later, they have a conversation that leads to a sale, and you don't even know about it. Twitter, in particular, which is obviously my main squeeze in social media these days, Twitter lets you do that online. Let me say that differently. Twitter lets you do online that which you do in everyday life. It comes closer to letting us behave the way we do in the store or in the marketplace. It allows us to have simple conversations. Sometimes these conversations lead to deals. Sometimes these conversations lead to jobs. Sometimes they lead nowhere at all. You never really know.
So we can start with a simple conversation that leads everywhere or nowhere, but if we don't start with a conversation at all, that's the sure way for it to go nowhere for your business.
You have a better chance of making the sale by starting with a simple conversation than you have by putting an ad on a page that pops and sizzles and moves when somebody's trying to read content.
Shell, that's a great way to end our show today. That business starts with basic conversations, starting with chatter, and certainly Twitter is perfect for that. And everyone, Twitterville does a great job of bringing this down to the level of any small business owner over to all of us so we can understand how to maximize these conversations. Shell, can you tell us where we can go to get more information about you, get your book?
Type in the word Shell Israel, S-H-E-L-I-S-R-A-E-L. On Google, and you'll find a lot of ways. You can go to twitterville.com to see my blog. You can go to Shell Israel, one word, on Twitter to see my tweets. You can see what I look like by going to Flickr, typing in the same Shell Israel. So,
well,
I'm pretty easy to find online.
Very easy for us to get in touch with you. Thank you so much for joining us today, Shell, the author of Twitterville, How Businesses Can Thrive in the New Global Neighborhoods. I've really enjoyed you, and I know my listeners have too. Coming up on Indie Business Radio over the next couple of weeks, we've got Mark Warnke, author of Options Not Obligations. Michael McLaughlin will be here, winning the professional services sale, and several other experts and authors to help you maximize your business no matter what you do. I hope you'll join us. Check out IndieBusinessRadio.com for more information, dates, and times of upcoming shows. I'll see you next week right here on Indie Business Radio. In the meantime, enjoy your life, build your and have your way.
You're listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com.